A reading from 2 Kings, chapter 5, beginning at verse 1. Naaman, commander of the army of the kings of Aram, was a great man and in high favour with his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. The man, though a mighty warrior, suffered from leprosy. Now the Arameans, on one of their raids, had taken a young girl captive from the land of Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." So Naaman went in and told his lord just what the girl from the land of Israel had said. And the king of Aram said, "Go then, and I will send along a letter to the king of Israel." He went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of garments. He brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, "When this letter reaches you, know that I have sent you my servant Naaman, that you may cure him of his leprosy." When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to give death or life, that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? Just look and see how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me." But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent a message to the king, "Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come to me, that he may learn that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and halted at the entrance of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a message to him saying, "Go, wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." But Naaman became angry and went away saying, "I thought that for me he would surely come out and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, and would wave his hand over the spot and cure the leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" He turned away and went away in rage. But his servants approached and said to him, "Father, if the prophet had commanded you to do something difficult, would you not have done it? How much more then, when all he said to you was, 'Wash and be clean'?" So he went down and immersed himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. His flesh was restored like the flesh of a young boy, and he was clean.
Teenagers are acutely aware of who is on the in and who is on the out. Most adults are too, though we are more sophisticated about it. Most people want to be on the inside if it means being included, accepted, and appreciated. Most people find being on the outside difficult, even if they pretend they don't. Societies have explicit and implicit borders about who is on the inside and how to join. Sickness, disability, and race are some of those borders. Ask any immigration consultant. Religions too have explicit and implicit rules about insiders and outsiders. There are boundaries about who is acceptable and who is not. One of the temptations of any religion is to equate its boundaries with God's boundaries. Presumption is the mother of all stuff-ups. It's not difficult to find boundary verses in the Bible. Israel saw itself as the chosen of God and other races as unchosen. In Amos 3:2, for example, God purportedly says to Israel, "You only have I known of all the families of the earth. Christianity has also suffered from bloated ideas of its own self-importance. Jesus' words, "No one comes to the Father except through me," have been usually understood as divine sanction for Christianity's alleged superiority. Yet, as I pointed out recently in a sermon on Jonah, there is a subversive stream within the Bible. There are writers and stories that challenge religious elitism, which is often just plain old racism in holy drag. These stories frequently have a plot reversal, where an insider is cast in a negative light and an outsider is portrayed as superior in faith or virtue. Think of the stories of Tamar in Genesis 38, Ruth, Jonah, whom I mentioned, the woman at the well in John 4, the Syro-Phoenician woman in Mark 7, and from our reading today, Naaman the Aramean. There was a history of conflict between Israel and Aram, also known as Syria. Recently, it had been Naaman who had led the Arameans to victory over Israel. It's fair to surmise he was probably not a popular man in Israel. He was an outsider, one to be feared, even hated. A skin disease, probably psoriasis or eczema, afflicted Naaman. It was not what we call leprosy. While Naaman's disease was no doubt irritating, the real illness was the personal and social stigma that went along with it. Like Israel, Aram believed that such impurities deemed one ritually unclean in the sight of God. The disease made him an outsider among his own people. Naaman was part of the hierarchical male world. The message of hope, though, for him, came in a topsy-turvy fashion from the bottom of that world. A girl, a slave, and an Israelite enemy lit its spark. It took significant humility, as well as desperation, from both Naaman and his master the king to act on her advice. The king of Aram, who thought very highly of Naaman, petitioned the king of Israel, his defeated enemy, and offered significant booty. It was to be a king-to-king deal, as that was the way deals were done. The king of Israel, though, did not have a master-to-servant relationship with the prophet Elisha. Prophets were a law unto themselves. Elisha was also a fierce opponent of the gods of Aram. Religious tolerance and inclusivity weren't really Elisha's thing. Appeasing kings, especially foreign ones, weren't part of his repertoire either. The king of Israel thought the king of Aram would know this. He thought the king of Aram was trying to bait him. He thought he was going to suffer. He rent his clothes in despair. Prophets always like it when kings rend their clothes in despair. Rending shows that they are desperate and therefore susceptible to leverage. So Elisha stepped in to help the king of Israel, and Naaman came to pay Elisha a visit. Then Elisha indulges in a little power game. Naaman expects to be treated with all the dignity and respect his position demands. But Elisha doesn't even appear. He just sends out an encrypted message. "Dear Naaman, go bathe 7 times in a Jewish river, you pompous foreign heathen. Love, Elisha." As you can imagine, Naaman has had enough. He has humbled himself enough. He does not want to submit his honor to any more abuse. He imagined himself instantly cured, not instantly ridiculed. Yet once again, by topsy-turvy grace, He listens to the advice of his servants and does as he's been instructed. Grace, though, doesn't heal him. Faith does. Not Elisha's bigoted faith, but Naaman's willingness to listen to underlings and in so doing lower himself. Naaman dipped in the Jordan. He plunged into a foreign religion and river. He lowered himself to listen to servants, even a girl, and take orders from a foreign pestiferous prophet. The outsider Naaman dived in. 7 times, humility and healing went hand in hand. Although in the aftermath, Naaman pledges allegiance to the God of Israel, thus becoming an insider, the Bible also tells us that he went back to Aram and assisted his king in worship in the temple of the deity Rimmon. He was an outsider who became an insider, but then remained on the edge, the borderland. The borderland is that region where many of us camp, that place between being an insider and outsider, where creativity and freedom are cherished, but the night winds are cold, where we live in the tension between belonging yet not fitting in, between believing yet rejecting many beliefs, between faith and skepticism. It's a good place, but often hard and lonely. St. Matthew's here exists for people on the borderland. The saga of Naaman has a salutary ending, omitted by our lectionary. A Jewish insider, Elisha's servant, Gehazi, is overtaken by greed. He connives to obtain the gifts that Naaman has offered Elisha, but Elisha refused. Gehazi is then struck with the skin disease that originally had afflicted Naaman. The story that began with an illness ends with it, the difference being that its victims have been reversed. The Aramean outsider has become clean, and the Israelite insider has become unclean. The Gehazi edition is not to warn us about the dangers of greed so much as to warn us of the dangers in presuming. Don't presume that race, heritage, and connections automatically mean that God will bless you. And don't presume the opposite either. Don't box God in on the inside or outside. God, like the wind, blows where she wills. To our peril, we ignore, shun, and vilify the outsider, and smugly imagine we have a monopoly on truth. This has been writ large last week in the controversy surrounding the lampooning of the Prophet Muhammad. Freedom of speech is critical in a democracy, and critical for any powerful religion like Christianity, where piety, power, and corruption can too easily coalesce. Yet freedom of speech is like driving a car. You can do it recklessly, displaying your machismo, or responsibly, displaying your tolerance. Too many of the responses to both the cartoons and the protests reek of cultural superiority, insider and outsider language, intolerance and certitude. Remember, presumption is the mother of all stuff-ups.